Everybody ready? Down here? Good morning, everyone. I would like to convene the February 10th meeting of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. I lost track of the date there momentarily. We're going to change the order up a little bit here on our hearings. We're going to hear House Bill 2051 first. I'm going to open a public hearing on that bill. I'm going to call up Mr. Angstrom first, rather than having our necessarily our technical witnesses. Mr. Angstrom's got business in a couple of different committees, and he's trying to keep all the balls in the air without dropping any of them. So welcome to our committee, Rich.
Thank you, Chair Witt, and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me get in ahead of everybody. It's I have Doganian's budget up at the same time today. And unfortunately, I don't know if many of you heard, but there was quite a tragedy that happened with the MLR director, assistant director over there, and it's kind of thrown that whole thing in an air. And not to go into a lot of detail, but it's a pretty upsetting situation. With that said, to the bill, my name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I represent not only the construction materials guys, but now I picked up most of the mining interest around the state. I now have the Eastern Oregon Mining Association under OCAPA, Eagle Pitcher, and other miners, and I'm trying to expand our coverage of mining interests around the state. On this issue of trespass, because it deals with real property, it would obviously deal with rock quarries and things of that nature that people like to go out and use as target range and sometimes their own private bomb range. And with that, we have seen some situations where folks have gone on to old rock quarries, used tracer rounds, and started forest fires. And so we think that this is a good bill. There are some issues that we would like to work on to expand the scope to make sure it covers that kind of situation where officers can get out, detain people, get them out of the get them off the premise, cite them, and we can, you know, take care of some of the mischief that's happening around some of our rock quarries. There's a couple of just small legal issues, but there's some folks that are behind me here that have done a lot of research on that and will advise the committee. So with that, we're here in support of this bill and these a couple of tweaks to it, but it looks like a good bill.
Very, very good. Thank you very much. Committee members, any questions? Rich has got to run anyway, so.
We don't have any questions.
He's on his way. Catch him in the hallway. No, that's fine. You're fine. We'll catch you in the hallway. thank you very much. Chuck? Yeah, do we want to call up Jessica next?
I think so, yeah. Jessica Minifee.
Okay, next I'd like to. Jennifer? Minifee?
Yes, I'm going to.
Would you care to be our technical witness, please?
Of course.
Thank you. Appreciate your appearance. Welcome to our committee.
Thanks.
And thank you for making yourself available.
No problem, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Jessica Minifee from Legislative Council. I was the drafter of this bill. I am here in part to explain, I think, some confusion that may have arisen from the measure summary that I wrote, which talks about reducing penalties for the crime of criminal trespass. I think how that came about is that right now criminal trespass in the second degree is a Class C misdemeanor, which is, in fact, a crime. Any criminal offense is divided into either a felony or a misdemeanor. There's ABC felonies. ABC misdemeanors, A being most severe, C being least severe. And then after you go down below a C misdemeanor, then you go into a violation, and you have an A, B, C, and D violation. A Class C misdemeanor carries a statutory maximum sentence of 30 days in jail and a fine of $1,250. And a Class A violation, ironically, actually has a fine that is higher than the C misdemeanor, which is a $2,000 fine. I want to explain a little bit more about the different sentences, though, that someone could receive. If someone was charged with a crime, they have the right to an attorney. They actually have the right to have a full jury trial. And if they are convicted, they have the ability to be placed on probation. They could go to jail. They could pay fines and fees. They could pay for attorney's fees, and they may pay for restitution. Whereas if somebody is convicted of a violation, the only sentence they can really receive is that fine. For misdemeanors, the fine can be anywhere up to that maximum amount. For violations, there's actually a statutory scheme that lays out minimum fines, presumptive fines, and maximum fines. And the presumptive fine for a Class A violation, which I think I have it marked somewhere, is $435. And that is the kind of fine where if somebody were to get a citation for a Class A violation and they wanted to take care of the citation without going to court, that's the amount that they would most likely pay. If they wanted to contest the violation, they could have a court trial. They would not have the right to an attorney, but then the judge could sentence them up to that $2,000 maximum. So, in hindsight, I probably would have written the measure summary a little differently, but in my mind, because it reduces criminal trespass in the second degree in some circumstances from a crime to a violation, overall, I think it reduces the penalties. So I hope that explains the differences between the two.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. And as we have found virtually unanimously with every bill that comes before us, it's nothing that an amendment can't fix. So with that, committee members, any questions for Ms. Menefee? I'm not seeing any. Oops, I'm
Chair
sorry,
Witt,
Representative
thank
Barrero. Thank you.
I'm just a Class A violation. Now, if there was, in this bill, was for three offenses, three consecutive offenses. Now, if they get a Class A three times and say they take the option of just paying the $435 fine, is there anything that happens after the third Class A, or is it just they just keep getting them?
If they have the two prior violations at the time of the third offense, it would become a misdemeanor. So it would be elevated back to what it is right now, which is a Class C misdemeanor. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for making yourself available. Certainly appreciate it. Next, I think I'd bring up Heath.
Yeah.
Next, I'd like to invite up, please, Heath Curtis. And Heath, if you have anyone that you would like to invite up with you, feel free.
Maybe on those second and third violations, we should have a license suspension.
Very possible. Good morning, sir.
Morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heath Curtis. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest Industries Council. This is the first time I've appeared before you this session. It's worth mentioning that OFIC's membership is comprised of Oregon's large industrial timberland owners. So you've got House Bill 2051 in front of you. I am here to testify in strong support of this bill with a minor amendment. And you may be asking yourself, why would the forest landowners be interested in actually decreasing, right, the penalties or costs associated with trespassing, criminal trespass on private lands? And the reason for that requires just a tiny bit of background, if you'll indulge me. In 2013, the Oregon Supreme Court handed down a pair of cases, Benoit and Fuller, and both of those cases recognized an earlier case that said that notwithstanding certain statutes in Oregon that authorize a prosecutor to decriminalize, to de-elevate a crime to a violation, to the extent that the crime carries with it certain attributes of a criminal proceeding, then the defendant is entitled to request all of the attributes of a criminal proceeding, including a trial by jury. So after 2013, what became clear to us is that many local jurisdictions don't have the resources to pursue a full trial by jury, particularly not for what, in the grand scheme of things, is an otherwise minor offense, such as trespass. And so the question became, how do you deal with that, right? I think, This is a short bill, and I was pleased to see it in the bill stack. OFIC didn't actually originally request this, but it actually, as you may know, involves a whole boatload of other statutes. This is a relatively sophisticated bill, and I want to go out of my way to commend the drafter. I think that she found a rather elegant solution to this issue. What she did is she said that in a certain narrow class of activities, it's actually a violation instead of a crime for the first two shots. And while we would love for criminal prosecutions to be brought against bad guys on forest lands that require the police to come out and visit us, the truth is that after Benoit is manifesting in little more than a ride to the police station or a ride off of our property, because the DA doesn't have the resources to bring a full-on trial. So from our perspective, giving the police officer in the first instance the ability, in fact, and obligating them to issue a violation instead of a crime, allows them to issue a citation for violation, and with it they'll write in the fine that they would say. The presumptive fine under this, as they said earlier, was $435, and that actually brings with it some real repercussions. Now note that this isn't you just have to pay it. It's also worth pointing out that the person can still plead not guilty, but in that circumstance, rather than being tried to a full jury, it's just tried to the court, and it's a relatively efficient process. There's also a number of other shortcuts. Affidavits can be submitted instead of oral testimony. It's a more efficient proceeding. So all of that is to say, while this may look on its face like we're downgrading or making less severe the penalties associated with criminal trespass, what we're doing in reality is actually bringing some consequences to those individuals who choose to criminally trespass. So if I may, we would, however, suggest that the classes of activities in Section 1, Sub 1, Sub B, where it refers to for the purpose of angling for, taking, hunting, or trapping wildlife, well, there are sometimes issues there with forest landowners in Oregon. I would say that, to be frank, many more problems are caused by other classes of activities, such as foraging for forest products, or gathering firewood, or target practice, right, or shooting on private forest lands. Those are all circumstances, I think, where we would like there to be some penalties, some consequences associated with those types of activity. From my perspective, while I started a couple days ago reviewing this bill and thought of a million different ways that I would like to change this, in the end I concluded that Legislative Council got it right. They are directly addressing the issues in Benoit. I would simply suggest that a larger class of activities be added. Notwithstanding my earlier representations about presenting alone, I have with me today Greg Miller with the Weyerhaeuser Company, and Chair Witt, if it's all right with you, I'd like to give him an opportunity.
Please do. Welcome.
Good morning, committee members. Chair Witt, for the record, Greg Miller, Weyerhaeuser Company. As I listened to Heath's description of expanding the examples, I thought maybe what I could add is a little value for, not a little value, but add some value to the record about the issues that we have out on our property relative to trespassing. So I receive on a fairly regular basis our security report from our security people that we have that patrol our properties, and I thought maybe if I could just read you a few incidents. They're not laborious, but it give you some context relative to what Heath is saying about these other activities. And I have just, this is just January through February of 2015. And to make it a little more compelling, for example, this is from one of our security folks talking about what he's running into. So here's, it's rather a little rough, so don't judge the grammar here, but was sent to the Chamber Mills gate regarding a call about people unlawfully cutting firewood by the gate. Suspect had a red Toyota pickup. We didn't find anybody at that time, but we have an issue of firewood cutting. I saw two quads heading up East Gaddyville near 300. They came off the 900, but did not go up it. I walked a portion of the system to see where I could find and come out, but I couldn't find where they came out. Those are folks that are running our road systems, and these are posted roads that basically say no trespassing. Here's one relative to water rights, believe it or not. Someone had laid a water pipe across BLM land, drawing water off of our property. Looked for the water pipe. It was buried on BLM after drawing water on Weyerhaeuser. This individual has no water right, didn't request BLM to allow him to run the pipe across the public road. He goes on to say, I was looking for the water pipe, but its conditions aren't, I'm going to go back and I'm going to go find this water system that's illegally placed on the property. Another one, contacted some people camping at our Razor Ridge Quarry. They had quads and dirt bikes. I directed them to BLM. They took down the camp, moved, picked up the dumped mattress and parts of the dryer and the refrigerator that were on the site. Cleaned up on Sunday, I cleaned up one shooting site. On Sunday, also found a party fire where the preferred burning material was tops of young Weyerhaeuser trees. Tops of 10 trees have been shot down and burned. Couple others real quickly. Cleaned up two dumpsters on construction material. This was reported last year. Didn't find a suspect. Again, more dumping. This is in February, just a couple weeks ago. Cleaned up trash and shooting debris on roads 500, 700, and 1300 gates. On Tuesday, cleaned up three shooter sites. On Saturday, found a new truck drive around between Sharps Road 400 and 300. So I probably could go on and on and on, but I just wanted to give you that context. And this is just in the matter of January through February of 2015. And I get these on a pretty regular basis.
So I can't contain myself. I'm compelled to make a statement here. Anybody wonders why it becomes increasingly difficult to find places to hunt on private property?
That's it.
Here's the answer. And for those who, I can't tell you the untold number of people that called me, wrote me, stopped me on the street when I went to the grocery store. Oh my gosh, they're charging money to hunt on private lands. Folks, here's the answer. This is why it's happening. And if we got slobs out in the woods, there's a cost to it. And all of us bear the cost. So, Greg, I'm sorry, but I just...
Mr. Chair,
it's horrible.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just close by saying that this is not an indictment of the hunting community.
I understand
the fishing community, all the folks back there. You know, all the good people are out there. It's just there are dopes out there and idiots, and that's the result. This is what happens. And so, thank you for the. Let me put it in context.
And speaking of dopes, was the irrigation system?
I think that's more to be determined when they find out where the end pipe is.
I'm sorry. Representative Frederick.
Love the technical term dopes and idiots, and I think you appreciate that.
It is Tuesday.
I would appreciate it if you can put in the record some of those list of those violations that you were talking about. I'm just a list of some form, because it helps in just explaining. As I read this, I wasn't sure just what those issues might be. And
yeah, I'd be happy to.
That would be just very helpful to have that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt, please.
Thank you. How often do you catch these people?
It's a pretty regular occurrence. Our security folks have discretion. That's, it all comes in judgment. And as Representative Krieger can probably tell you, you know, it's a matter of determining how far you want to take it. A lot of times, it's just a matter of giving them the look and knowing that they're security's out there and they skedaddle. But it happens pretty regularly. We come in contact. I think the technical term in the enforcement lingo is contact with that individual.
I recognize on the land as much as Weyerhaeuser would own. This probably isn't practical, but we use cameras for access into, we have a place in Montana, and there are just a few accesses into the place, and we use cameras and, you know, entries that people can't see. And I was wondering if that's legal for a prosecution to use a camera to catch them.
So I mentioned earlier that this is well outside my area of expertise. I would think you would have a chain of custody problem there, but I honestly, I don't know, and I would encourage, if you want to know more, I can try and seek out a DA or somebody who practices in the area.
It's interesting because they have the time and everything on them, you know, some of the new ones. So it's something worth looking into for private landowners or, you know, nothing as big as Weyerhaeuser. You're not going to keep track of everything, but...
Chair Witt, Representative Woodsit, we have used from time to time trail cams when we have particular areas that around the issue of truffle hunting, because truffles are pretty valuable, and we do issue commercial permits for legitimate truffle hunters. So folks will use that technology from time to time.
Chairwood, if I may, you may be asking yourself if, you know, this is the structure, why wouldn't we include simply all activities and make them violations instead of misdemeanors? And I just wanted to put on the record that I think that there are some circumstances under which particularly egregious activity merits criminal prosecution, and the DA would find the money, right, and the time to bring a jury trial. We're just saying categorically that there are other activities where you get two strikes before you get the misdemeanor, and we're trying to define what those are. We've thought, you know, hunting and fishing were appropriate, and we would propose that that section be expanded to other classes of activities.
Very good. Heath, can you give us just a brief synopsis of what Benoit was about and what it said?
Yeah, sure. So the Benoit case was in 2013. It also involved criminal trespass. It was against a group of 50 Occupy Portland protesters. And in that circumstance, the protesters were arrested and taken downtown. And the DA tried to use one of Oregon's statutes that allows you to decriminalize a misdemeanor to a violation, ORS 161.566, and the court said that notwithstanding this statute, if a proceeding has certain attributes of a criminal proceeding, then they have to be treated as criminal proceedings under your rights, under your entitlement under Article 1, Section 11. Important attributes that stood out to the court there, and they cited an earlier Brown case, were the fact that you were arrested and detained, the idea that this is and has historically been understood to be a crime, that it imposes some burden on your reputation. It's not a crisp and precise standard, but as things start looking more like a crime, then the court will find that you're entitled to your rights under Article 1, Section 11. And so the way that legislative counsel approach this is they said, look, we don't want this to be fuzzy. We're going to say in this area of activity, these categories of activities, that the only thing available for the first two strikes is a violation. That doesn't have the attributes of a crime, and therefore the defendant would not be entitled to all of the entitlements under Article 1, Section 11 of the Constitution. So that's, I would say, a quick summary. Again, though, there are others, I'm sure, who actually practice criminal law who could speak to you much more elegantly about the issue.
That's great. That really helps. Thank you. Thank you very much. Any additional questions or comments for our panel members? Vice Chair Krieger, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We, for years, fellows, have been aware of trespassing and what's taking place out on forest land with industrial. But small woodland owners, even like myself, you know, I had my fences cut last year, cattle got almost to Highway 101, and when they get on there and cars start hitting them, guess who's liable? So what's going on out there now? And of course, that's during archery season. You don't even know they're around, they get dropped off and they're gone. I wanted to ask Heath a question. Now,
a lot of this has come about as a result of the district attorneys not prosecuting. Do you know what ORS 496-630 says? I'll read it to you. I don't think you do.
Please.
It says, upon information or complaint of the State Fish and Wildlife Commission or any person authorized to enforce the wildlife laws, district attorneys shall. It doesn't say can, might, if they want to. They are not given discretion to prosecute every case in which appears there has been a violation of the wildlife laws. So the same district attorney that's prosecuting people for laws isn't following the law that says what he's supposed to do. That's our problem.
Yeah, Chair Whitaker.
They were doing their job, and some of them are doing an excellent job. We wouldn't be having this bill.
Chair Wood, Representative Krieger, I would agree with that. I'm not familiar with that statute. I would, however, say that the solution, in my mind, is generally speaking, may not be to hold their feet to the fire on that particular statute, but to adequately fund those offices. If a DA is having to choose between a homicide case, which requires spectacular resources, and this, while we like to think these issues are burdensome and a big deal, I would say that they're probably right to put our second. That said, this bill does allow the officer and the DA some discretion to try and squeeze these in as they can, and we think that would be a good thing.
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment. And I understand what you're saying, but I've been in the building here now 15 years working with the district attorney. Some of them are outstanding. Some of them are lacking. You can go to the counties that are not prosecuting, and I can show you case after case after case that they prosecuted, and you think, well, my God, why did they do that? What was so important about that? Maybe we should add a penalty clause on the DA if he doesn't prosecute in that statute.
You don't have to respond.
I do have a priority bill, and I'll be talking to some of the members.
Thank you for the coaching, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both very, very much. And I just want to say you've helped to clarify this bill in my mind, so thank you. I was wrestling with this thing for the past couple of days, and I now see the need for the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Gail Meyer. Yes, he is. Good morning and welcome to our committee.
Wish I was that bright.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. It's my first time before this committee. I'm Gail Meyer. I'm the representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm here because I saw Co-Vice Chair Krieger yesterday, and I said, thank you for structuring Section 3B as you did. And he said, well, why don't you come on in and tell the committee that? So I just wanted to have a teachable moment here and just sort of highlight what happens very frequently in criminal cases and how you calculate what's a repeat offender and where do you put the hammer, where do you either put the additional penalty or where do you escalate it from a smaller crime to a larger crime. What we like about the way Representative Krieger structured 2051 is that he put the hammer after there was a prior intervention of a criminal proceeding. So what they've got here is they've got offense, well, conviction, punishment. And then what 2051 says, if you're dumb enough to do this again, we're going to hit you harder. And that's where we as criminal defense lawyers see that it has the most impact, because when the criminal justice system can intervene, there's a lot that goes on. There's something very concrete about having, you know, metal around your wrists and a photograph taken of yourself that's on the internet, and your lawyer telling you whatever you were doing is getting you in trouble, you need to stop, because if you keep doing it, something worse is going to happen the next time around. So we like that. What you do see sometimes, and not necessarily bills before this committee, but in any committee, any bill you may be voting on, it can sometimes jump to the other side. It can simply say multiple events end up in one judicial sentencing proceeding, the judges impose the sentence on the first conviction, you're considered a first offender. 1 minute later, they're sentencing you on that second conviction, and that's where the elevator and the bump sets in. And in our opinion, that's a little bit too soon. It looks different in different kinds of crimes, we admit this, but there's something very powerful about that intervention of the criminal justice system, and when the offender is punished already and then repeats their conduct, we think it's appropriate then to put the elevator, the hammer, whatever you call it, the enhanced penalty at that side. So 2051 got that right, in our opinion. We wanted to thank Representative Krieger for structuring it that way. So
wonderful. Thank you very much. Yes, so Representative Esquivel,
I'd like
please.
To caution Ms. Myers on giving too much credit to Representative Krieger, because we're going to have to pitch in and get a shoehorn so he can put his hat on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The young lady who's testifying has driven to Curry County twice.
True.
And been on the back of an ATV over my tree farm. Then she came back with her boyfriend and had dinner with us. So we do have a relationship that might be different than I have with some lobbyists, because most of the lobbyists I don't let come to my house.
I highly encourage anyone to take up the offer if you get one. It's a fun time. So.
Any further questions for our witness? Thank you so very much for your testimony.
Thank you,
Chair. We truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up Stan Steele, Al Elkins, and Tom Wolf. And do we need another chair here?
This thing is really a lot different than what people thought it was.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll get it fixed.
Good morning to each of you.
Good morning.
And thank you for your appearance.
Good morning, Chair Witt, committee members. My name is Stan Steele, Rallis, Oregon, representing the Oregon Outdoor Council. This is a great bill. Looks at a situation in Oregon that we could correct and provide a lot of relief for a diverse group of stakeholders. Both those who want to comply with Oregon hunting and fishing laws, as well as the landowners that seek compliance or give permission for those who do. I've handed out a handout that actually just kind of runs down what's already been said. Puts it in front of you as telling about the Class A violation, presumptive, and et cetera. But one of the key things that we need to understand is that the number one fish and wildlife or hunting violation that our Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Troopers deal with is criminal trespass, hunting on lands of another without permission. It takes up an extreme amount of time. It's very cumbersome. You go out when you could be actually working on other fish and wildlife violations, trying to detect an illegal kill of an elk or whatever it may be, and you're spent working on some guy that has actually encroached on a landowner's property. So you lose your valuable patrol time. And with that, then what goes to court, if it does get filed, well, often doesn't. So what you've done is you've been just a gatekeeper. You've ran somebody off, but you really have had no law enforcement effectiveness other than you run them off this property, they can go on to another. So you might actually contact, and I have in the past, being a OSP Fish and Wildlife Officer, several people, same people in the same day, running them off two different places. So, you know, being a referee isn't really what we need to do, but we do have to have some rules to allow us to actually work on a problem. This does. We worked with private landowners while drafting this bill, the concept of it. Thought it was just an extremely needed change, and it's a reboot, an upgrade. We're modernizing a law that actually moves into this decade, into this century, and gives us the ability to actually, well, be effective. And we always said fair and firm enforcement. This bill is that. The fairness is this. We're giving you two strikes. If you want to be a serial trespasser, well, strike three is going to be a fastball, high and tight, and you're going to be going to the court under a different set of circumstances than the first two. So with that said, I'm sitting in the back of the room today smiling and watching Oregon work. And a concept that has been discussed for years, finally put in paper, and it needs some work. There's still some amendments, some friendly amendments that need to be done. But I'm also smiling and saying, we're moving in the right direction. This bill does that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Who's next?
Chair Witt, commissioners. Sorry, I was thinking of ODFW. Chair Witt, committee members. Hey, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf.
Obviously, put down.
Exactly.
Obviously, I have this whole microphone director thing on my mind quite strongly. But anyway, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Travel Limited. I'm here to support this bill. We think it's an excellent bill. And speaking on a personal note, I grew up, as many of you know, born in Enterprise, lived in Pilot Rock, Hood River, Seaside. And I remember when we lived in Seaside, my father would take me hunting on private property for ducks and things. And it was easy to do that. And you know, we got on, no problem. And over the years, you can't do that anymore for various reasons, because many people have violated trespassing. This law is really addresses that in a positive note. And speaking as a fisherman and listening to Chair Witt's diatribe against the lack of hunting exits, the same thing's happened in the fishing. You know, a lot of, you know, for example, a lot of rivers in if you fish for salmon or steelhead, a lot of the lower rivers are on private land, and because of people trespassing, people have lost access to fishing those rivers now, or else the landowners have started charging to do that. So we've lost access because of the violations of trespassers, that not only do they do that, but they leave litter along the streams. That also adds to the problem. So I support, Travel Limited supports this bill. We think it's a good bill, and hopefully this will address many of the problems we have in the state. Thank you.
Tom, thank you very, very much, and appreciate the fishing community turning out for this hearing very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, members of the committee, for the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. We have an extremely good working relationship with timber companies around Oregon, and we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of hours, volunteer hours, cleaning up timber sites, also monitoring gates and locking them and opening them, make sure who goes in and is recorded and who comes out is recorded, just as important. And we would like to continue working with them on this bill. They had some suggested amendments this morning, and we would more than support what they're attempting to do. And we support the concept of the bill and would like to continue working on it.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair, also, Representative Krieger made a point about the prosecutors not doing their jobs, and we brought that up at the last hearing on the fine fee increase bill. And if we could have that as part of our discussion and what we're going to attempt to do with judges and prosecutors around the state, that would be very helpful as well.
Al, I agree with you. I think it's a discussion that needs to be had. I want to say right from the get-go that there are a number of us here among the 90 members that need to take a little responsibility here, too, because there is a cost factor. And that's not to excuse a lack of prosecution in some counties. It seems to be some more than others. But I agree with you. We need to have that discussion, and we need to get at the heart of the problem. We need to begin finding solutions to this, so that let's face it, we ought not to make it safe for people to go and violate the law in some counties. It's bad. We need to treat everybody the same throughout the state. I also want to make the comment
I hunt in a closed area, closed to motorized vehicles. I hunt on a mountain bike, and the folks that I run into checking the gates are OHA members. So appreciate all of that public service that people do for free. So thank you very much. Questions or comments, Representative Esquivel?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You just painted a scenario, Stan, that you chased people off property and found them on another property. With this bill, would you be able to cite them for the first and the second, and then they've already had their two strikes, and next time we prosecute? Is that the way that would work?
Chair, with
different properties.
Representative Esquivel, I think that's a great question. There is case law, and I'm by far not a lawyer. I was just a field guy. All we let the lawyers tell us what we needed to do and when we need to do it, basically. But if I was to find a violator in the same day, say, for example, no, there wouldn't be just an automatic ramp up on that because the court process would not have been completed. What we would do, though, what's unique about this is that it's really not unique. In many fish and wildlife violations right now, the field troopers do not, after the issue of the citation, which is that's the start of a court proceeding. The citation is actually the first court document that puts people into the system. And then what will go on is if it's ruled a violation and no culpable mental state, the trooper actually will be not only the person who detected the crime, but he'll be the person who prosecutes the crime. The district attorneys can get involved in the case prep if the trooper has a question or not sure of something, but the DA does not have to get involved, and that's the beauty of this. It streamlines the system, makes us much more effective, and the court costs are just minimal for the simple fact that you are going to have the court assessment for court costs, but you don't have the DA involvement in those first two strikes. And it would be a great question. I would think that I would defer to other legal minds on actually ramping that up on, say, a double dip in one day would be a good way to put it. Hope I answered your question, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. I guess the one question we all would also have is, do we have to reduce the penalty or could we raise the penalty? I know we're raising other things and creating other things, but we're not much of an organization that likes to see penalties decreased. So if we could talk about that as well, and that would be helpful.
Al, we're going to have a little work group on this bill, and my intention would be it's going to be a quick series of amendments that will be brought forward, and Vice Chair Krieger can look forward to having this bill back before us here in fairly quick order. With that, Representative Gorsuch, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to support what you were saying about, you know, the enforcement issues. And the one thing to point out is that we have to make sure that the Oregon State Police are fully funded, both sides, but especially Fish and Wildlife, because you can't get any of this done if the troopers aren't there to do it. And I think it comes back to what you said, Mr. Chair. We have to look at what the authorized strength is for that agency and make sure we fund it to that full authorized strength.
Absolutely. Anyone else?
Chair Witt?
Please.
Representative Gorsuch, thank you so very much. There's a statute that outlines how many Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife officers we have. And the key word in there that we need to remember in that statute is appropriate amount. And so the discussion of what is an appropriate amount is absolutely spot on for legislation such as this. Right. Do we have appropriate amount of troopers? Are they funded to be the most effective that they possibly can be? You know, my first blush answer after being gone for quite some time from that agency is no, we're less effective today than we were then. Population's over 4 million in Oregonians now, but yet you have the same amount of troopers working the field as I when I retired in 1998. Great insight. Thank you, sir.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to add on to what Stan just said, in 1976, we had approximately 600 and some troopers. Population has expanded substantially since 1976. Today, I think we're just under 400 troopers.
Right.
So we are losing ground, and the reason being is because we use it as discretionary funds for to fund the state police. And myself and Representative Olson have a bill in. We've had it in ever since we've been in this building to do funding and earmark funding and direct funding for the state police and take it out of a certain pot of money and dedicate it to that and bring it up to the national average of troopers per thousand and then from then on dip it back into the general fund.
Thank you very much. Any further questions or comments for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Committee members, I rely on these three individuals, among others, but I rely on these three on a fairly regular basis, and I don't want to chase them off because I'm probably going to need their help in the future, and I don't want them to stop coming to this committee simply because they're worried they're going to get assigned more work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask that Vice Chair Krieger be the point person for anyone who has suggested amendments, and I would recommend that you rely very heavily on these three people for that process, and then we'll see if we can't make a good bill great and get this thing back before us here in short order. And Vice Chair Krieger,
as you said, Mr. Chair, anyone that did have suggestions for amendments, make sure you get them to us. We'll try to pick a day where we can meet for half an hour, put it together, and get it down to legislative council. I'd like to say sometime between now and Friday, contact my office. I get here about 6 in the morning. If I can do it, you can do it.
Okay, folks, everybody's got the word, and we would truly like to get this back before this committee as soon as possible. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Is there anyone else from the public who'd like to testify this morning on House Bill 2051? Bill, come on forward. Good morning, Bill.
Morning, sir.
Welcome.
Chair Witt, committee for the record, Bill Jr. including. Thanks for letting me testify. I heard mentioned, you know, that some of these rural counties are hurting. Well, I will testify that rural counties are hurting. They can't afford to fully man their district attorney's office, judges. So it's a free-for-all out there, and I won't go into why these counties are broke, because I could sit here all day and talk about that, but I would like to see something drafted to the effect that these rural counties, if they have a backlog in their court systems, especially on wildlife violations, that the Attorney General's staff step in. All they should have to just contact the Attorney General's office and say, hey, we need some help, and the state should be obligated to fulfill that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Cluding? Not seeing any, Bill. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. Last and final call on House Bill 2051. Anyone from the public wishing to testify today? I am not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2051. And with that, I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2534. Mr. Gallagher, can you tell us a little bit about this bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure directs State Fish and Wildlife Commission to adopt rules prohibiting use of drones for angling or hunting, or use of drones for interfering with lawful angling or hunting.
Where's the sign-up sheet on this one?
You're going to testify?
I'm going to testify.
I was going to say, what are you doing out there?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Excuse me, Brad Witt, House District 31, appearing before you this morning in support of House Bill 2534, which directs the state Fish and Wildlife Commission to adopt rules prohibiting the use of drones as aids in the conduct of hunting and fishing. The bill similarly calls for rules prohibiting the use of drones to interfere with the lawful pursuit of hunting and fishing activities as well. As the Benn Bulletin opined last week, and I quote, "Drones can take the sport out of hunting. Drones can make scouting game easier. Live feeds can enable real-time tracking. Add in thermal imaging, and it can be much easier to pick out prey across the landscape," end of quote. And I would add that much of the same thing applies to fishing and fishing-related activities as well. Committee members, drones have no place in sport hunting and fishing. They are simply antithetical to the concept of both a fair chase or a fair catch. And again, in the words, quoting the Benn Bulletin, House Bill 2534 helps keep hunting and angling sporting, end of quote. And by adopting House Bill 2534, Oregon will become the ninth state to either ban or be in the process of banning drones for hunting and fishing. And committee members, I would strongly urge you to support the bill and, in fact, become the ninth state. Let's ban the kind of technology that just makes fair chase, and fair catch rather impossible. Thank you very much, and would make myself available for questions, Mr. Chair.
I do have one, Mr. Yes. Chair. It says angling, hunting, harassing, and tracking.
Yes.
I don't know if you're talking about tracking as after something's been shot or something, but the idea of just using the drone for locating game, I think you need to add that word or something similar to that in there. The very concept of not being able to hunt after, you know, using an airplane for a certain length of time is because you're actually locating the wildlife.
Yes. And Chair Krieger, I think that that may make sense. The current statute would suggest at least that there's an eight-hour window after using a drone that you could not then go hunting or fishing. It has been suggested to me that in terms of drone usage, which may be very specific to targeting an individual herd of animals or that sort of thing, that in fact an eight-hour window may not be a sufficient amount of time.
Yeah.
And I am more than open, if that is the desire of the testimony that we hear from the public, to extend that beyond 8 hours. I am more than open to doing that. I also want to point out there have been some questions about the bill and its reference to tracking in particular. And if you read the language of the bill, it says harassing or tracking as an aid to angling or hunting. So it is within the context of hunting or fishing that it would ban that kind of tracking.
Committee, have any questions?
Question. So, what happens if a person is out on their own private land and they're just playing with those things? I'm just trying to determine, would they have to have a fishing license or a hunting license to prove that they weren't just out playing with them? I mean, I'm talking about big rural areas where on someone's private
yes.
land.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, again, this bill always speaks in the context of hunting or fishing. So you would have to be engaged in those activities in order for this bill to apply.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad, do you think maybe we should do that 24 hours after?
Mm-hmm.
Because an elk herd can move 30 miles in 24 hours.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, that is what I've had several different parties now suggest that to me. Mm-hmm. And I was frankly conservative initially. I would frankly be pleased to extend that to 24 hours. So. Mm-hmm.
Good bill.
Okay. Great bill.
Thank you, committee members.
Good bill.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Brett Brownscombe. And Brett, if there's anyone that you would like to bring with you, please do so. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Brett Brownscombe, Acting Deputy Interim Director at Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I have brought to my right, Ron Anglin, who is the department's Wildlife Division Director, with me, just given the subject matter of this bill and the subsequent bill up for hearing. So I would like to, on behalf of the department, just offer some brief comments on House Bill 2534. And first off, recognizing the intent of the bill, the department embraces the values of fair chase. And I can remember when I was living and working in Montana, meeting Jim Posowitz, who wrote the book Beyond Fair Chase, and that was many years ago, but that book still remains highly relevant in embodying the spirit and principles and ethics of fair chase, and I see it sprinkled around the office at ODF&W amongst many employees, and the intent of that bill, of this bill, fits well within that context. What I wanted to recognize first off is that, as referenced earlier, there is currently in ODF&W's administrative rules a prohibition, and this is also captured in big game hunting regulations, a prohibition on hunting or using aircraft. And 3 years ago, that term was defined to include drones. The rules prohibit the use of aircraft, including drones, in the hunting context as an aid to hunting. In the fishing context, this bill provides additional guidance and direction to the commission. What I wanted to touch on briefly is just some potential unintended consequences in the way the bill is written that I wanted to raise in comments here for the record and ideally work through the department, work with the chair and interested stakeholders in the bill on. So the first off is the bill uses drones as defined in ORS 837-300. And in that provision of statute, there is an exemption for model aircraft. A lot of the model aircraft technology that's out there right now could very well be used in a way to do the kinds of things that this bill would set out to prohibit. And so it may be that defining what we're talking about as drones or unmanned aerial systems or whatever the term of the day is, there may be a different statutory reference. The same is, another comment is, the bill also, it refers to, in section 125, It refers to use of drones for the purposes of angling, hunting, harassing, or tracking as an aid to angling and hunting. This is probably one of those lawyerly issues of the use of the word or versus and what distinctions in the use of or and can mean. There may be, from the department's perspective, valuable reasons to use technologies such as unmanned aerial systems for purposes of harassing wildlife. And I say that with examples in mind, such as protection of property. If there are geese, for example, and an unmanned aerial system can be used to help harass geese away from property to prevent damage, that's one example. Using the technology to harass wildlife away from a hazardous spill site, for example, could be another example that comes up. So I think from the department's end, we just want to make sure that the language as crafted is truly intended to get at the issue of fair chase and prohibiting the use of this technology for purposes of hunting and angling, and doesn't spill over into potential other areas where there may be valuable reasons to use the technology, and that the department has, or the commission rather, by direction through this bill, has the discretion to craft rules that meet the fair chase intent of the bill, but minimizes having to be sideboarded into some unintended consequences that we may be able to avert. So with that, I'll end my comments and be available for any questions. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the bill.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments? The department, I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, excuse me, the bill speaks to hunting, or rather lists a number of activities, viewing wildlife, that sort of thing, tracking, chasing, with respect to hunting and fishing. And I am very open to some additional language that would tighten that up so that it would provide you the level of comfort that I think you're looking for. So we'll get a small group together, and if you'd bring some suggested language for that, it would be greatly appreciated.
Absolutely, Chair. We'd be happy to work with you and committee members on that.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Anything else, committee members? I'm not seeing anything. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that, and look forward to your input.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Scott Beckstead. Good morning, Scott. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Thank you. For the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director and Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States, here today in strong support of House Bill 2534, the bill to ban the use of drones in hunting and fishing. The Humane Society of the United States does not oppose sport hunting, but we do oppose hunting methods that are unreasonably unsportsmanlike and unreasonably cruel. And so we believe, as an organization, that the use of high-tech drones to locate animals puts those animals at an unfair disadvantage. And we notice that the trend is definitely toward states moving to adopt these kinds of measures, and we think it's a good thing. So we would offer, or we would suggest, a yes vote on this bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Scott, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. Call up, please, Al Elkins, Kevin Thompson, and Stan Steele.
Good
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. This bill is one that we requested to have drafted. We work closely with Representative Krieger and his office on this bill. We're a traditional values type organization, no laser this or laser that or drone. We want to make sure that the language is tight, that it allows ODFW to do their surveys if they want to use a drone to do yes. their surveys. In discussions with Representative Krieger during the interim, we talked about tracking, which I think we need to have further discussions on. I know he brought that up earlier this morning. And also, I think we had discussions about traps and trapping, but I don't recall what we decided to do with that language. But the hunting, harassing, and tracking are some of the words that we developed as we went through the process. Locating animals may not be considered tracking in terms of those that go out hours before or the night before, the day before, and use drones to survey areas. So we also need to make sure that we include some type of word that will get at that activity. The chairman of our board sits on a river in Colorado this time every year, or Arizona, and last year he was sitting on the banks of the river, and a drone went overhead and followed the river. So Joe Ricker is his name. He followed it when it came back past his camp and went to the camping site. And the gentleman was a outdoorsman, fisherman, and was, after a long discussion, had the video of where the hot spots were on the river to fish and where the cool spots were. And so he was using that to as a tool to determine where he was going to fish that afternoon or the next day. So they are being used, and I think it's time that we step up, Oregon does, and get this taken care of. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very, very much. Who's next?
Okay. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Thompson. I'm the president of Traditional Archers of Oregon. Traditional Archers of Oregon, of course, supports adoption of rules prohibiting the use of drones for angling and hunting. One of the guiding principles of TAO is the promotion of fair chase through limits of technology use in archery seasons. This does not resonate with our principles, simply. So thank you very much for your support. You guys are doing good work. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and appreciate your testimony today. Thank you for being here.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Stan Steele, representing the Oregon Outdoor Council. Fair chase. It's what our outdoor heritage sports are based upon. Nothing more and nothing less. We have weapons now that are capable of reaching out, well, almost a mile. There's no chase, and there's nothing fair in that, in our opinion. And these aren't traditional values. And the use of drones to identify our next target or our next cast just doesn't seem like fair chase. I think when you're, like I am, having three very young grandsons that you're exposing to this great outdoor world, the one that actually has guided our lives, been the core of fabric, is fair chase is something that we all have to understand, and our sport will actually disappear without fair chase. At some point, chase turns into just killing, and it's far more than that. So I think the drone bill absolutely addresses issues that we have to be very cautious of as we move forward. Technology, it's incredible. It advances every day. There's something new every day. Laser sights, whatever it may be. So this is a good bill. I think at the NASC convention, those of us who were really fortunate to go over there, listened to Mr. Steve Maley, former director of Idaho Fish and Game, put on an incredible seminar about fair chase, what it means to all sportsmen. This bill actually puts that into code and helps us a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for this panel? Vice Chair Krieger.
Stan, I was down in Las Vegas at the SCI convention, and there were 24 booths
with guns that could put something in a 4-inch square right. at a half a mile, some said a mile. Wildlife uses smell, sight, and sound. At some point, if we're actually sportsmen and want to make sure that hunting prevails as a part of our culture, that's going to have to be looked at. And I'm saying looked at. I'm not saying how you're going to curtail it, but it needs to be looked at because the animal out there at a 3/4 mile alfalfa field eating doesn't know anything's around. That isn't fair chase. That's just plain killing.
Representative Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, I think one word sums up what you just said, and that's amen.
Mr. Chair, oh, I'm sorry. Mr.
Please,
Chair, Representative Krieger, we're working on that, studying what all that's about. We're collecting information at the board level. We'd be glad to address that if you would like.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was watching on the Outdoor Channel, I was watching them taking coyotes, which a coyote isn't very big, you know, that's a small animal. And they were taking those things at 12 to 1,400 yards. Now, personally, I can't see 12 to 1,400 yards, but that's almost another zip code for me. But I know my eyesight, my abilities are stunted once you get past about 300. But I think that we need to address some of this because, I mean, 1,200 yards, 1,400 yards, that's a heck of a long ways. You know, that's almost 3/4 mile, so.
Yeah, as you talk about fair chase, I'm not even sure there's any chase involved in that instance.
There is no chase.
So, anything further for this panel? Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much, and I want to. We're not done, obviously, with our witnesses yet, but before this particular panel is dismissed, I want to just say that I am encouraged by everything that I have heard, not only from our witnesses but from this committee as well, and the general public. Conservation is alive and well. In the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you,
Chair Witt. Chair Witt?
Yes.
I just had one question, and Sal kind of brought that up in that in the promotion of this sport, you know, there are a lot of channels that do movies, and would these things be acceptable in filming for those? I mean, it's going to come up, you know, so... One of the things is as we're promoting the sport and promoting fair chase, you know, in the promotion setup, you know, there may be room for that. But I just wanted to.
I think that's a extremely good suggestion, Representative. Extremely good, and something that I think we all need to have in the back of our mind because there've been some very good things said here today. Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I'd
like to call up next, please, Joe Rollator.
Chair Witt, members morning. Of the committee. My name is Joe Rollator. I get my mail in Walport, Oregon. I have the unique job of representing both sports and commercial fishermen. I represent the guys that work out on the ocean. I also represent a big trout farm in Eastern Oregon. We support this bill 100%, and fair chase is really important to me personally. As a commercial or a sports fisherman, I think that's very important. But because as a commercial fisherman, sometimes when we put our gear down, we attract birds. And we deal with that with flagging and kites now. It may be in the future that we utilize drones to protect those birds from getting entangled in our gear. And I think Scott and my other friends will tell you that if you hook a bird, It's really difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
They're very vocal. They are very scared of you, and I don't like doing it. I've done it twice, and it's not a good deal. Never done it sports fishing. It's always commercial. So, and also at our trout farm, we find that we use netting, we use flagging, we use propane cannons, but the birds get used to that. And so it's an attritional thing, and I think that in the future, I'm sure ODF&W will use it, use drones to harass birds to keep them away from eating things that we don't want them to eat. So in the future, we may find a very positive use in fishing for the drones. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joe, and I want to give you every assurance we want to make sure that you and the people that you represent continue to have an ability to harass those birds that may be trying to steal your catch or get in the way of your operation. And we want your input. I specifically want your input when we look at amendments for this bill.
Chair Witt, up in Alaska, there are a couple of fisheries that have a bycatch of birds, and two birds caught shuts the fishery, multi-million dollar fishery, down. And so it's very important that we figure out ways to avoid that. And by the way, I want to add again that my clients support this bill.
Thank you very, very much. Vice Chair Krieger, please.
The bill refers to angling, which is hook and line. Mm-hmm. Fishing is not angling. It's a commercial activity.
Correct.
So right now they would not be included.
Thank you.
But we need probably a statement saying that it doesn't include.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Krieger, as you well know, having drafted many bills to deal with fish and wildlife issues, oftentimes there are unintended consequences, and that's why I brought this issue up.
Thank you so very much, and we're going to make every effort with your help to make this crystal clear, or as clear as we can possibly get it. Thank you very much. I'd like to call up finally Don Byard, please. Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Chairman Witt, members of your committee, my name is Don Byard, and I'm a past president of the McNary Golf Club. And I just got wind of this bill, and the word in there that bothers me is harassment. We have a significant goose problem on the golf course, both eating the grass and leaving a mess for the golfers to wade through. I'm sure you're familiar with it if you're a golfer. We spend up to 56 hours, man hours a week, patrolling the course to keep the geese from coming in and settling down. I clearly don't understand the difference between a toy helicopter and a drone. I looked at the definition, and it was difficult for me to define what that is. I know what's up at Fry's Electronics in Wilsonville, and there's a whole row of these drone-type vehicles that you can just buy and go out and run. And I don't know if a drone-type vehicle is going to be effective for us. But I do, however, have a vision of a drone controlled. Maybe it's got an eagle, simulated eagle head on it, and it flies with GPS over a controlled area, and the areas that where the geese are most prevalent. And one of the areas that we have a problem with are the lakes. If we can scare them off the golf course, yes, but then they go in the lake and we can't get them out of the lake, because as soon as we leave, then they come back onto the green grass. So, but if this drone system would work, it would save us a significant amount of man hours out there patrolling. The point is that these drones have a possible positive application that have not yet been explored. And I guess I'm representing the unintended consequences of a bill like this if you don't define what you can do, where they are useful. We are adjacent to a farm area where geese are actually hunted. So in one case, they're attracting geese. In our case, right across the property line, we're trying to get rid of them. So there's a possible conflict there between enforcement of the bill if you don't focus it truly in the hunting and fishing areas. This is in the past, we've been able to use fireworks to help get rid of the geese, but that was eliminated a while back with some laws that were passed or regulations by Fish and Wildlife. And I think that you need to look at the other side of these regulations. It causes a lot of turmoil to come back and adjust laws that have been passed. This is clearly exemplified by House Bill 2432, still in the process this session, where fireworks may now be permitted on golf courses, airports, and estuaries and other places that we didn't think of when we passed those regulations earlier. So we've had to do without those things, and we look forward to using fireworks for use on the golf course to discourage the bird, the birds from coming in. I also developed a vineyard in 1973 in nearby Eola Hills, and I've had a lot of experience with birds in that case, robins and starlings mostly, and not necessarily game birds, but they are birds, and I also see an application for a drone use in the vineyards. So I guess I support the bill in the context of just strictly hunting and fishing, but not without considering what the positive aspects are for drone use in relationship to harassment of other animals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bard. And we've tried to limit this bill just to hunting and fishing, and I very much appreciate your proactive approach here, coming into our committee and making sure we get it right so that we don't have to go back and correct something after the fact. We're going to recraft a little bit of language here and try and provide that level of comfort not only to you and the folks that you represent, but some of the other folks who've testified here today, so that there really hopefully will be no question at all that this is limited to hunting and fishing only, and it doesn't cast a broad net. So appreciate your comments very much. Committee members, any questions or comments? I am not seeing any. Sir, thank you very much for your testimony. Certainly appreciate it. Is there anyone else that would like to testify today on House Bill 2534? I'm not seeing anyone. I am going to be the point person on providing that additional language. We are very fortunate that we have Ms. McGee from Legislative Council who's set in on this hearing and I think probably has a feel by virtue of the testimony that she's heard the kind of language that we need, and I will be working with her and anyone else that wants to approach me with recommended amendments on that bill. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2534 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2536. And Mr. Gallagher, can you tell us about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure requires applicants for license, tag, or permit to angle, take, hunt, or trap to attest that applicant consents to inspection of license, tag, or permit and taken wildlife. Requires the attestation statement and proof of attestation to be printed on the license, tag, or permit and signed by the applicant.
Thank you very much.
Did I open a public hearing?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did. Yeah. Wanted to make sure I got that. Didn't skip a step there. Committee members, I'm just going to make a couple of brief comments here from my chair. The intent of this bill is to help overcome a constitutional problem, unreasonable search, when law enforcement would like to make random field checks, you know, whether somebody's got an extra fish or something like that in the creek. The intent here is to have an affirmative attestation by the individual who purchases the license or tag that would be printed on the license or tag that, in essence, gives your consent to be searched. It's not a panacea by any means, but I am told that it would be very helpful in terms of a couple of recent court cases. The specific language is in the bill. I'll, in the interest of time, let all of you read that. And with that, I'm going to, if anybody doesn't, any questions or comments so far, if there are none, I'm going to call up then, please, Ron Anglin. And Ron, anybody that you would like to have come forward with you.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And Brett drew the drone bill for testimony this morning, and I drew the attestation bill. I had to practice that.
Very good. Welcome back.
I have to say, Chair Witt, you've thrown me for a loop this morning. You've moved people around up here, and people that used to sit over there are sitting over here now, and I've got to readjust.
Ron, it happens to the chair, too. I go to call on Vice Chair so-and-so, and it's, whoop, wait a minute. So,
you know, the department appreciates what the bill's trying to accomplish. We're going to be happy to work with the committee on accomplishing that. We looked at it from what I'm going to say is the trivia associated with the bill and what might be considered some kind of unintended consequences you may not have thought about. You know, one of the things we hear from our hunting community is that the tags are getting bigger, we've got to carry more paper in our pocket, et cetera, et cetera. And for the first time ever, I actually went and bought a sport pack this year. Mm-hmm. And doesn't include my deer and elk tag yet because we don't issue those. But if I carry everything with me as a hunter, this is what I'd have to carry with me right now. And while that doesn't seem like much, you know, you got to stuff it in a pocket, you got to carry it with you, and you got to remember to have it with you. And, you know, the way the bill is written, it's pretty inclusive. It includes all of our licenses, tags, and permits, and that's over 2 million documents a year that we issue. And what that works out to in the language that you have proposed in the bill would take up about 2.5 inches of space on the license and the tag, and it would add this much more to what our license is. So it would increase the volume on all of the licenses and tags and permits. And what does that mean for us? Well, it was astounding to me. Our folks ran the numbers, and it's an extra 79 miles of paper a year. So, you know, just to put it in perspective, by including all of that on the license, what that means. Right now, there's no cost to the department on that because it's written into our contract that our license vendor bears the cost of all the paper. But eventually, if they ran that back to us, that would be about $38,000 a year in increased expenses. So we'd like to figure out a way that we can get where you want to go on this without having those kind of impacts to what our hunting community is telling us that, and fishing community is telling us what they do and don't want to carry around, and just kind of the nitty-gritty of having something like this work. So that kind of gives you just a little bit of background and a little bit of perspective on some of the implementation aspects of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
The question that I had is talking about the license as it is today. How long has it been since you reviewed what's on the license right now?
Chair Witt, Representative McLean, we actually review that every year. It was a couple of sessions ago that there was language added. I think it was Representative Esquivel's bill that specifically gets at the felon language and that you're attesting that you're not a felon when you purchase one of the licenses. So that was some stuff that we added at that point in time. We currently have pulled together a group of folks that are looking at the wording of our residency language and looking for a way and working with the Oregon State Police to shorten that up and make it more concise and reduce the amount of space it takes on the license. And our plan is to implement that this year as part of that review. So we're looking at it pretty constantly.
Please.
Well, my second question is that, you know, the concept that they're trying to get at here seems so important to me as far as making it easier for you and others that work for you to be able to do the right thing, which is do these field checks and be able to do it in a way that there's not any controversy and or conflict. And so I just, you know, if there's $38,000 worth of too much printing and there's too many inches on your license, I think it's time to look at what can be removed, as you stated, on the license to get this on, because to me, this is pretty important stuff. It helps the system work better, and it helps folks that are trying to be inspectors have an opportunity to do their job better, and I like that. So I guess I'm saying to you, I think there's a commitment, you know, by the chair and the sponsor, that this is, you know, important to the program or to the system. So it's a problem solving, you know, problem that we have to figure out how to get this important language there.
Chair Witt, Representative McLean, really appreciate that. And in talking with one of the folks this morning about the bill, was really looking at, you know, they described to me that they were looking for some ways to provide more surety for enforcement officers and ODFW to require stops and be able to submit the information as requested. And, you know, we have experience with that, obviously, and being able to do game checks from a department standpoint. More recently, experience in our bill language with that we share with the Oregon State Marine Board on the invasive species boat checks. And for several years, that was a voluntary system, and we had people pretty much blowing by our check stations until the legislative body made it mandatory that boaters had to stop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are the types of things that if that's what you're looking for, you know, we're fine with that. We want to work with you to make sure you've got the kind of language that gets you what you want.
I just want to give you an example. When we started having smartphones in the schools, there was no way to actually, you know, make sure that you had the attention of students that weren't using, you know, the technology for the lesson until we had them sign their name that you do not use your technology in the classroom unless the teacher has indicated that it's appropriate for the lesson at hand. And they had to sign it, and their parents had to sign it. So, I mean, it's powerful. It's powerful to have someone actually make an obligation to be part of the system and be part of the classroom or be part of the experience in hunting and fishing with these ramifications. So I think there's a real need to make sure that we're getting the commitment of the person that we're trying to bring into the system.
Thank you very, very much, Vice Chair.
I'm sorry,
Chair,
I don't know why. It just felt important to say.
Thank you very, very much. Vice Chair Krieger.
Happen to have a license.
They
almost look like Dead Sea Scrolls. Remember to report. You don't need that four times in that length of time.
Put it on the back.
You're wasting time. I mean, space. You talk about that. On the two documents that I'd have to have, there's over 9 inches used for that alone. That's not necessary. The other thing is, if you go to the license, you've got a dead space here, here, and here of about 3 inches. There's room to do it with the paper you got now. You just got to reconfigure it.
Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments?
Chair Witt,
yes.
if I may, on
please.
And Representative Krieger on that. I know I checked into that yesterday, and I know on the back of the license, we don't actually print on the back of the license. That's that side of the license is basically stock. The only printing that occurs is on the front side. So if we were to print on the back, we just need to have a conversation about the cost of not only printing on the front but the back. So there may be some things that seem relatively simple that we could do, and maybe we can. I think we want to have those conversations, but there also may be some issues where it's not quite as simple as it might appear.
And we recognize those challenges, and there may even be some opportunities. Some of the font is significantly larger than the rest of it, and it may not need to be quite as large as it is. So anyways, if you could take a look at that and see where you could squeeze that in, it'd be appreciated. Representative Gorsuch.
Well, very much like Representative Gilliam admitted yesterday, I am not a lawyer, so please forgive me. However, it strikes me that with an Oregon driver's license, that we have implied consent in terms of the breath test. And so my question is, why does someone have to sign it on the license? I mean, why can't it just be put into statute that's an implied consent? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Representative, again, I'm not any constitutional scholar by any means, but I have been told by some that there have been some cases of recent where, again, this isn't carte blanche. You can stop anybody anytime for anything,
right.
But it may help for some game checks. So. With that, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the back of this, I see that this is just run out repetitiously, and we do our printing on the front, and that's where we can make the change. I was wondering, why do we have to state in here how many years or months we've lived in the state of Oregon? Can't we just say, I, the undersigned, attest that I've been a resident of Oregon for more than 6 months?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, we're actually making changes to that right now, and that's one of the things we looked at.
I think it's embarrassing I have to put my age on here. But you don't have enough space for me to put in the years.
So,
guess the three digits is wrong.
That's right.
You don't have to use Roman numerals, you know.
That's right.
I'm sorry, Chair Witt.
Between that and all the moss that drop out with the money, I mean, it's embarrassing. But anyways, any further questions or comments for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Tom Wolfe and Rich Angstrom. Welcome back to both of you.
Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolfe, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Just very briefly, we support this, Trout Unlimited supports this bill. One of the big concerns we have among our members is enforcement of fish and wildlife regulations, and there's a big problem in this state with poaching, whether it's hunting or fishing. And you know, I share with you some of my concerns about poaching of sturgeon last week, but it's a big problem. And if this bill will help make enforcement easier for the state police and easier to do their job, then Trout Unlimited supports it and will work. And we understand ODFW's printing concerns, and we hope that that can be worked out. But we think this is a good bill, and we support that it moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Hi, Chair Witt.
Good morning
members
again.
Of the committee. I've had a crazy day already.
So, how many times have you testified so far before 10 o'clock?
This is my third.
And very good.
And we're only in week two.
There you go.
So, Rich Angstrom. I'm the, again, the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association, also a hunter and fisher. I represent mine and mineral interests as well as the construction materials. I wear a little slightly different hat on this one as I've been puzzling over this bill. And what I would say is, just from a legal perspective, I'm troubled by these things in the bill. Currently, the law allows for state police to ask for folks, any hunter and fisher that they encounter, to display show them their tags, and they can inspect their game. And it's done under administrative search provisions that the department has. And they're not – administrative search provisions, the reason they get away with that is it's not just for unlawful activity. It's for conservation purposes. You know, we look at tags and things of that nature and gear to make sure we're protecting wild coho and all kinds of other reasons why – we allow the department and the OSP to do these things. When you do a consent search, and that's the current law, and it's pretty rigid. Under a consent law, if you put this in here, remember consent has to be free. It has several components. It has to be free, it has to be voluntary, and it can be revoked at any time. It doesn't matter if it's in writing or not. And I think what's happened here in this bill is it conflates the two approaches. And I actually think in its present structure, it actually weakens what I think is already a fairly strong administrative search function. So I've identified the issue. But what I do think is that I'm not going to get into the cost of having to redo the tags and things like that. But the one thing that could be stated on the tag is that pursuant to administrative search provisions, all fishers and hunters have to display their tag and allow their game to be inspected. And that is conforming with the current law versus creating an administrative search function and then a consent that you can revoke. So if I play this out, I was out on buoy 10 and officer came up and said, hey, I want to check you out. And let me see your game and let me see your tag. And I said, no, I don't think I want you to do that. He says, well, you've consented to on your tag. Well, I says, well, I revoke my consent. And what is he going to do? So I think it kind of confuses how that administrative function would work. So I actually don't think it's as helpful with this approach. But I think it is good to identify to the fishers and hunters that under administrative search provisions that they're required to show their game and their tags. So I think you can do it differently. I just don't think this bill does it the way I think it makes a problem instead of solves one. So with that, it's kind of a little legal analysis. And for those folks that are new to the committee, I was a DA and did all the game cases for 10 years before I took this job. Granted, it was 18 years ago, and the laws evolved probably a little bit. But I can't believe it evolved that much. And so that's kind of, you know, where the basis of where I come from on that. I do think that there's a poaching issues out there. I think the officers and all the series of these bills are getting at trying to get officers to be able to have more contact with folks to be able to put a lid on some of this. So I'm with everybody on the goal. I just think this one confuses things. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very, very much. And Tom, appreciate your support. And Rich, thank you very much. I think what you've stated casts a whole new light on this, and I'd ask that if you wouldn't mind making some suggested language that we could perhaps take down to LC, I'd appreciate that.
You bet. Mr. Chair.
Of course, I have a question.
Vice Chair McLean and then Representative Gorsuch.
I appreciate your comments today, but perception is, you know, important. And in a classroom, actually, I have administrative rule over my classroom. I get to decide what happens in that classroom, how it happens, and I get to create the classroom rules. And what I find many times, though, that is if you bring the students along and you get them to understand what the benefit of those rules are, or if you get them to consent to those rules, that these are rules that they're willing as a class to agree to function under, that again you have less conflict. And I don't always think that the courts or administrative, you know, rules or, you know, whichever, you didn't tell us where it was codified, so I don't know the number. But it doesn't always have to be the law. It has to be something where people want to be part of the system and they want to create and they want to understand, you know, why other people in the system are doing the things that they're doing. So I appreciate that, but again, sometimes I'm making it a rule or a regulation versus a consent or a cooperation, they bring you different things. And I think that was what I was trying to say, and I don't know if you were in the room or not. But it's a situation between what is legal and what is doable and what brings the best results.
Thank you very much. Representative Gorsuch.
Well, with all due respect, I would suggest that in this case, this is a policing function out in the field. And if you can get somebody to consent, that's fine, but sometimes people will not consent. And this isn't, we're not trying to build a consensus out there. We're trying to let OSP officers search and do what they need to do. So I understand what you're saying. It's better to bring people along, but I think you have to have the ability to say what you said. You just say it clearly, mm-hmm. and then you don't have that confusion. The second piece, though, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
How far can the search extend for this sort of thing? I'm just kind of, it's an aside curiosity of mine, but how far can we go with this search? If I'm an OSP officer and I say, okay, I want to see your cat.
So, Chair Witt and Representative Gorsuch, what happens with administrative searches or even consent, we'll start with consent. Most officers, because of the restriction on search and seizure law, now rely heavily on consent. And the ability of an officer to get consent to do a search or and push the inquiry along is really a function of how good that officer is being as a people person. Officers that are fairly stiff and stoic have a harder time getting consent, and those that have the gift of the gab, like me, get folks to pretty easily to do consent. But that's highly variable, and it's a very tough way of trying to make game cases, which by their nature are hidden and in the dark, and people know how to hide, and you know, and real poachers are fairly sophisticated. What happens is, in my experience on consent, is the cases are made by the unwitting, the folks that just made a mistake and didn't know they made a mistake. The true criminals know not to give consent and how to play the game. The administrative search function is just allows for conservation, conservation function. So, but on any stop, whether it's a consent inquiry, which isn't a stop, but a consent inquiry that escalates because the officer has a rightful place to be where he's at, he starts a conversation, asks how, you know, what the guy had for dinner and how his kids are, and then he notices a blood stain. And then he says, well, where'd that blood stain come from? Well, I cut my finger. Yeah, but that looks like deer hair. And so The point is the consent, as well as administrative search, allow the officer then to observe things and then escalate the inquiry. when the officer reaches a point of having probable cause, which is a series of questions to get there, he can then escalate the contact into a search, more of a search and seizure, and more of a criminal investigation. And it's pretty well laid out. It's for the officer's perspective, it's really hard to make those contacts, and you know, people just they can wave, they can be on a forest road and wave at somebody, and they're just going to keep on driving by. They can't do anything. They can't stop them. And so having a law enforcement done from a consent perspective is a tough way for the officers to do business. Mm-hmm. So, but that answers your question of how it escalates up and how an officer will take an easy issue like, you know, just looking at a tag, and then he is able to move that into something else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I first started hunting back in the early 70s in eastern Oregon for mule deer, I remember out of Prineville they always had a game check. And I haven't seen a game check, I'll bet, in 25, 30 years now. I'd like to see us do more of those, because every year you knew when you went over the Ocho Coast and you came back by Prineville, they'd pull you over and, because, I mean, gee, can you tell I've been hunting? You know, I'm in camouflage, I've got guns in my rack, and I've got my camping gear. So I'm just, what did you say, Representative?
Something about you being a great hunter, but you never kill anything.
So I'd like to see us get back to those, is what I'd like to see. And if this is some kind of a way we can craft a vehicle to do so, then so be it.
Very good. Chair Witt and Representative Sal Esquivel. You know, I've been gone through a bunch of those game checks myself, and I thought they were great enforcement. They could set them up anywhere. But you're now fighting this, the Oregon Supreme Court, which picked this issue up sometime just before I got to law school. And what they held, in essence, this is pulling a little memory, so there's some nuances I may have forgotten at this point, but that constitutes an unlawful stop and then search functions. You have to have reasonable suspicion to stop somebody, a police officer, and they just can't willy-nilly start pulling people over, creating game checks. And so it became a Oregon constitutional decision not to allow that. But With that said, we need to find more tools for the officers. Besides, actually, I consider a consent search a very weak tool, myself. It's what we got, but it's a very weak tool. But you know, we can't also, and you may not like this, but we can't trample all over the rights of the hunters and fishers out there that are lawfully doing stuff. And in this case, it actually picks up a lot of other folks that have to get swept into that. They get stopped and delayed for doing nothing other than driving down the road. So I from my side, I'm just kind of saying it the way it is, whether it's popular or not. But I think it's important to say what it is.
Well, Rich, with your help, we'll try and get that language as improved as we possibly can, improve that tool, and still remain within the Oregon Constitution's limits on search and seizure. So thank you.
You bet. I'll get you a draft and Stan and those folks just some language that I think might work.
Great. No other questions? Thank you both very, very much. Appreciate it.
Evidently not again.
He's off and running. Thank you. Real quick, if I could, Stan Steele and Al Elkins. Gentlemen, if you can be the professionals that you are, and a minute's worth of testimony each, we can get out of here on time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I'd just like to add to what others have said, and we'd be glad to help in this endeavor. I want to make sure that we get the language right.
Yeah.
And I would like to make sure that OSP, Captain Samuels, is part of this process. And maybe at some time we can sit down and talk with prosecutors and judges in relation to these fees and fine bills that we're doing and have a dialogue before we print and move these on. Thank you very much.
And when you get a chance, Al, sometime, come up to my office and I want to pick your brain a little bit on how we have that meeting.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Witt, committee members, my name is Dan Steele. Quickly, prior fishing game guy. We lost checks. We lost the most effective field tool that we had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bottom line.
Right.
We can say we were politically correct and say that whatever we want to say, we can say Supreme Court, but Representative McLean actually is hitting the nail straight on the head.
Yeah.
We have to find tools to make us be effective in combating, really, an out-of-hand poaching problem in Oregon. If we don't do that, hunting's going to suffer, our economy's going to suffer, and, well, our quality of life is. We wrote this bill with one intent, to get those inspections back. In the handout that I gave you, you'll see that Idaho hasn't. It's not against the U.S. Supreme Court. It might be against the way we're having this current court in Oregon interpret it. But does that mean we don't keep trying to find a solution to a problem that enables us to protect our fish and wildlife and our heritages? So I can kind of get just a little touchy on this because it is that critical to us. 13 listed species of salmonids in Oregon. I took 22 illegal coho out of the trunk of a car at a game check. If I don't have those checks, those 22 went home. That's 22 fish, maybe half of them hens. That's 60,000, 70,000 eggs that never hit the spawning bed. In other words, it's critically important to protect our calf elk, trophy mule deer, or whatever. So we'd be very willing to work with language. To not do anything with working and trying to get this back would be irresponsible. And just once again, shackling our fish and wildlife enforcement capabilities in Oregon. Thank you.
Stan, thank you very, very much for such an impassioned statement. It's palpable. It's thank you for that. Questions or comments for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you so very much. And Stan, my commitment that we're going to get that, we're going to get as close to the random check as we can. We may not get there 100%, but we're going to get as close as we
thank
can.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. With that, Mr. Gallagher, would you tell us what we've got coming up Thursday?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, next Thursday we will be looking at a hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2501 requiring that the annual report from the state forester to the emergency board would include private property loss information for fires of 1,000 acres or more. House Bill 2653 requires State Department of Agriculture to establish standards for locating apiaries in residential zones in Oregon. And HB 2687 provides exception to the offense of carrying a dog on the external part of a vehicle for persons operating farm vehicles. And that's what we have coming up Thursday.
Thank you very much. Anything for the good of the order? Seeing none, hearing none, we stand adjourned. Thank you, committee members, and we stand adjourned. Thank you, committee members, and...